Thank you for choosing to take a self-guided tour with free tours by foot. We believe in operating quality tours that are affordable to everybody, regardless of their budget, and we hope that you enjoy your tour with us today. You've chosen to come along on our Royal Westminster self-guided tour, a walk that will take you through this exceptionally beautiful part of our city, telling you the stories of all the kings and queens who have shaped the way we see London today. This tour will have you standing at the entrances of royal palaces, walking in the footsteps of British history's biggest names, exploring centuries of history, as well as gossip, and will finish with an opportunity for you to take a picture with the most famous clock in the world. On the tour today, you can expect to walk nearly 2 miles, or just over 3 kilometers. The tour will last, on average, just under 2 hours, although this may change depending on your walking pace or stops you wish to make along the way. For guests with mobility issues or those with prams or buggies, there is only one set of steps on the route, and there is an alternative spot to place yourself which will point out to you at the time. To help you get an idea of the time periods we'll be discussing today, we're also including a small chart with all the names of Britain's kings and queens dating back to 1066, as well as the years of their reigns. This will be a reference point for you as we discuss various monarchs throughout the tour. This self-guided Westminster walking tour begins near Green Park Underground Station. When you get to Green Park, take the exit for Buckingham Palace. As you step outside of the station, you will see a black water fountain. Walk straight past that fountain and follow the path through the park. When the path splits into two, take the path to your right. The path will end on the edge of Green Park, just across the street from Buckingham Palace. If you stand facing the palace, there should be a long road leading up from your right. You can listen to the next clip about Green Park as you walk. Stretching out over 47 acres, Green Park has a royal history dating back through the centuries. Originally, the land here was a burial ground for the nearby leper hospital of St. James. The land was bought by the Crown during the reign of King Henry VIII, who demolished the hospital and used the surrounding land here as a hunting ground. Later, in the reign of King Charles II, the land here was officially made a public park, although it was surrounded by a large brick wall and could be closed off to the public whenever the king wished. Before Westminster was truly part of London, this area was essentially the outskirts of the town, and in the 18th century, the park became a haunt of thieves and highwaymen, as well as a popular spot for dueling. Public access to Green Park has remained open since this time, and today is traversed by thousands of people each year who walk through the park to get to Buckingham Palace, as you're doing now. When you get to the bottom of the park, you should be facing Buckingham Palace, and to your right will be a long street. Once you're there, play the next clip. The street to your right is called Constitution Hill, despite the fact that it is not a hill and that the United Kingdom does not have a written constitution. The road gets this name because in the 1700s and 1800s, doctors told people it was good for their health, or good for their constitutions, to take a walk every day. So very rich men and women would put on their nicest, most expensive clothes and travel out to Buckingham Palace, so they could be viewed by as many people as possible. They would then casually stroll up and down the street, taking what became known as their constitutional walk. Eventually, this practice gave the road here its name. Queen Victoria took constitution walks here also, but she took hers in the back of her carriage, which is a little bit like going for a jog inside of your car. However, Londoners would line the streets in their hundreds to see Queen Victoria, as she was a hugely popular figure. For a start, when she came to the throne in 1837, aged only 18, she was devoutly religious, and she had been raised in a notoriously strict home. And this was in direct opposition to the two kings that had come before her, her two uncles, George IV and William IV. They had both come to the throne in old age, George being 57, and William, previously the oldest monarch to ascend to the throne, at age 64, although he was recently surpassed by King Charles III, who was seated at age 73. Both of the men were known for lavish spending, constant eating and drinking, and their inability to provide heirs to the throne. George's only legitimate daughter, Princess Charlotte, had died in childbirth, aged 21, and William fathered 14 children, but none with his wife. So when Victoria came to the throne, the public was ecstatic to have a beautiful young Christian girl instead of the two debauched older men that had been reigning for the previous 15 years. Throughout Victoria's reign, her popularity would fluctuate up and down, but by the time she died at the turn of the 20th century, not only had Victoria become one of our most famous monarchs, but she had also broken the record to become the longest-serving sovereign the country had ever seen. This is why, as you may have noticed already, nearly everything in London is named after Queen Victoria. The big white statue with the gold angel on the top, to your left, opposite the palace, is the Victoria Memorial. To the left of the statue, off in the distance, you can see a tower rising over the trees with a very tall flagpole on it. That's the Victoria Tower, which sits on the edge of Victoria Park, which is right around the corner from Victoria Street. You'll also have seen the Victoria Train Station, Coach Station, Victoria and Albert Museum, and the Victoria Line on the London Underground. All because she was on the throne for over 63 years. However, in September 2015, Victoria's record was broken by Queen Elizabeth II, who reigned for just over 70 years. We have now begun naming some of our London landmarks after Her Late Majesty, and you'll see a good example of this later in the tour. Also, in 2022, the Elizabeth Line on the London Underground was officially opened, so Her Majesty now has a train line just like her great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria. Speaking of Victoria and Elizabeth, I now want to show you the building where they both spent a great deal of time. To get the best view of Buckingham Palace, stand at the bottom of Constitution Hill, with Buckingham Palace on your right, and walk forward along the stone partitions. Continue in that direction past the black gate with the gold trim and up onto the raised pathway where there are white flagpoles just up ahead of you. Walking on this walkway gives you the best view of Buckingham Palace, the Queen Victoria Memorial in front, as well as the flowers of the gardens. If you're unable to make the steps, simply stop in the pedestrianized area in front of the black and gold gates, the Canada Gates, and position yourself to face the palace directly. Or you may choose to cross the street and stand directly in front of the palace itself. The choice is entirely yours. Here you have your perfect view of Buckingham Palace, known the world over as the home of the British royal family. The first record of a house on this site comes from the 1620s, but the house that would become the core of Buckingham Palace was erected by the Duke of Buckingham in 1703 as a lovely country manor named Buckingham House. Later, in the 1700s, when King George III came to the throne, he decided to purchase Buckingham House as a gift for his wife, Queen Charlotte. George and Charlotte spent a lot of time here, and it was seen as a bit of a retreat from the hustle and bustle of court. And it was here that 14 of George and Charlotte's 15 children were born. Throughout the centuries, the building has evolved. In the reigns of George IV and William IV, the house was heavily refurbished and drastically expanded as it slowly turned from a small country house into a royal palace. It was then expanded again in the reign of Queen Victoria, and it was she who would first use Buckingham Palace as an official primary royal residence. In the early 1900s, it was expanded and refurbished by King Edward VII and King George V, bringing the palace up to the look and design that you see before you today. Contained within the walls of Buckingham Palace are 775 rooms. There are 19 staterooms, 52 royal and guest bedrooms, 92 offices, 188 staff bedrooms, and 78 bathrooms. Although Buckingham Palace is the most popularly known London residence of the reigning monarch, the royal family has other palaces, castles, and houses throughout the country, which means the monarch isn't here as much as you might think. In fact, King Charles uses Buckingham Palace more like an office, and hasn't spent a single night here since he came to the throne in September 2022. And it's very easy to find out whether or not His Majesty is currently in residence at the palace simply by looking at the flag on top of the building. Contrary to popular belief, there's always a flag on top of Buckingham Palace, and it's the type of flag that determines whether or not the king is home. Whenever the blue, white, and red Union flag flies on top of the building, it means that His Majesty is not home, because this is the flag of the United Kingdom, not the flag of the king. His Majesty has his own personal flag, known as the Royal Standard. It's a combination of four squares in shades of blue, red, and gold. Two squares are red with three gold lions, which represent England. One is gold with a red lion, which represents Scotland. and one is blue with a golden harp, which represents Northern Ireland. Whenever you see that flag on top of the palace, it means the king is currently in residence. Which, in a weird way, means the king can never hide from us, because the flag will always give him away. Our next stop is along the Mall, the long red road that stretches directly in front of the Victoria Memorial and Buckingham Palace. If you listen to the last clip standing on the raised pathway, simply continue following around and then, at the end, take a left onto the Mall. If you listen to the last clip in the pedestrianized section in front of the Canada Gates, simply follow the road along to the left as you face Buckingham Palace, and it will bring you to the Mall as well. If you listen to the last clip in front of Buckingham Palace itself, cross back over to the edge of Green Park, and with the palace behind you, take the path to your right. Follow it around until you come to the Mall. Continue along the Mall, away from Buckingham Palace, until you can see a huge iron gate on your left. This is your next stop. Behind the gates are two large houses. The sandy-coloured Lancaster House on your left, used for royal functions, ceremonial events, and filming, like shows such as The Crown, and then the white-coloured Clarence House on your right, the official home of King Charles III and Queen Camilla, who both lived here for years before Charles became king. Clarence House was designed by architect John Nash in the 1820s and was originally built for the Duke of Clarence, later King William IV, and has since been passed down through generations. Princess Anne was born here in 1950, and in 1953 it became the London home of Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, until her death in 2002. The house was also, at one time, the official residence of Princes William and Harry. Today, the Prince and Princess of Wales, better known as William and Kate, live near Windsor, and Prince Harry and the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan, have stepped back from royal duties and live in California. While standing here, you will notice two Kingsguard soldiers on the right. Please keep in mind that if the weather is bad, they may have retreated into the little blue-gray boxes on the right just in front of Clarence House, which might make them hard to see. If His Majesty is not in residence, then this is your opportunity to get a view of the Kingsguard soldiers, and you should play the following clip with detailed information on the Kingsguard here. If His Majesty is in residence, extra guards are placed in the courtyard of St. James's Palace, which gives you an excellent view, and you should play the following clip when you get there. To get to the next stop, stand with Clarence House on your left. Continue down the Mall for just a few minutes until you hit Marlborough Road. Take a left and walk until you get to the large courtyard on the left-hand side. If His Majesty is in residence, here you will find two extra guards. If not, you'll be looking at two empty guard boxes. The world-famous Kingsguard soldiers is a contingent of infantry and cavalry soldiers charged with guarding the royal family, as well as their property, a job which they've had since the 1660s. Many people have the idea that the job of a Kingsguard soldier is to stand in one place all day long, not speaking or moving at all, but this is not the case. For a start, Kingsguard soldiers work in shifts of 2 hours each, and throughout those 2 hours, they do move around quite a bit. Every 10 minutes, they come to action and do a march of 15 paces before returning to their position. Usually, they only do the 2-hour shift twice a day, but occasionally they may be required to do it 3 times, but that is the maximum. It's also worth keeping in mind that all of the Kingsguard soldiers are real, active soldiers. They all have full military careers, like all other soldiers in the army, and they can be sent on deployment throughout the globe, as any other soldier can. This means that when you see them standing outside the royal properties, it really is just a small part of their full-time military career. Specifically, all of the Kingsguard foot soldiers come from the infantry division of the military, which gives us some more information about them. Firstly, if somebody is old enough to be in the army, they are old enough to be a Kingsguard soldier, which means some of them are younger than many people expect, at just 18 years old. Secondly, infantrymen are all trained in weaponry, so this means that the guns are real. As to whether they are loaded or not, that's something we can't comment on. Lastly, up until quite recently, female soldiers were not allowed into the infantry division of the military. This means that, despite the fact they were previously all employed by a woman, the late queen, no women have ever been queen or king's guard soldiers. But perhaps the most famous aspect of the king's guard soldiers is their uniform, specifically the hat. These hats are known as bearskin hats. As the name suggests, they are hats made of bearskin. It is real bearskin, and most of the skins are given to the military from Canada, from bears that are legally culled. Each hat is approximately 18 inches tall and weighs 1.5 pounds, or about 0.68 kilograms. We'd also like to draw your attention to the fact that the hats you're looking at now may have decorative plumes on them. The plumes vary in color and position and identify which regiment the guard belongs to. There are 5 regiments that make up the foot soldiers of the King's Guard. Grenadier Guards, with white plumes on the left side of their hat. Coldstream Guards, with red plumes on the right side of their hat. Irish Guards, with blue plumes on the right side of the hat. Welsh Guards, who have green and white plumes on the left side of the hat. And Scots Guards, who have no plumes. The most well-known event surrounding these soldiers is the changing of the guard, and if you would like more information on that, including our tips on the best places to watch, the best times to arrive, and further information, just check out our handy guide to the changing of the guard on our website at www.freetoursbyfoot.com. If you're still at Clarence House, stand with Clarence House to your left and walk down the mall. Take the first left onto Marlborough Road and stop outside the courtyard on your left-hand side. If you're already at the courtyard, simply stay where you are and play the next clip. You're now in front of St. James's Palace. The Palace of St. James is not as well known as places like Buckingham Palace, but as far as the royal family is concerned, St. James's Palace is number one. This is the senior-most palace in the United Kingdom. This is because St. James's Palace is the official residence of the monarch. Despite Buckingham Palace being the more famous building, St. James is home to what's called the Court of the King, known as the Royal Court of St. James. When I say Court of the King, imagine His Majesty sitting on his throne, and then surrounding him dozens and sometimes even hundreds of people, decisions, organization, and planning. It's essentially the extended household of all the people who regularly work the closest with the monarch. For many people, St. James's Palace is their first introduction into the atmosphere of the royal family. All foreign ambassadors and high commissioners who are visiting the United Kingdom are welcomed at St. James's Palace, and those ambassadors who represent the United Kingdom are formally accredited here. Even if ambassadors or commissioners are attending events inside Buckingham Palace, they all come to St. James's first, before being escorted down the Mall to Buckingham Palace. St. James is also the official meeting point of the Accession Council. The Accession Council is a large group made up of many high-profile members, such as members of the House of Lords, officers of state, aldermen of the City of London, and high commissioners of the Commonwealth realms. They have the job of meeting at St. James's Palace upon the death of any monarch, as it is their job to officially proclaim the successor to the throne. Obviously, these days, they don't tell us anything that we do not already know, as the heirs to the throne are public figures. But the ceremony still continues, and today, essentially, confirms the identity of the new monarch. The last time this happened was the proclamation of King Charles III on the 10th of September, 2022. It's worth a mention also that St. James's Palace is where the changing of the guard begins. The guards that are based here will begin the ceremony by leaving this courtyard and heading down the Mall. So if you wish to watch, this is a good place to position yourself. And it's fitting that the ceremony starts here rather than the more famous Buckingham Palace, because this is the court of the reigning monarch. With the courtyard on your left, continue walking forward until you get to the end of the palace and turn left. Walk until you get to the big black door gates on the left-hand side. This is the original gatehouse to St. James's Palace, remaining largely unchanged throughout its centuries of history, aside from the clock, which was first added in 1731. Even though today St. James's Palace is the home of the court of the king, it was originally intended to be a home for the king and his wife, and this is one of our most famous kings, Henry VIII. In centuries gone by, there had been a leper hospital on this site, the Hospital of St. James. Henry VIII purchased the land and had the hospital knocked down so he could build himself a new royal palace on this site. Construction of the palace began in 1531 and was completed in 1536. Henry's intention was to use the relatively small St. James's Palace as a cozy getaway from his larger palaces such as Whitehall or Greenwich. During construction of the palace, Henry was married to his second wife, Anne Boleyn, and he had their entwined initials carved into all the woodwork inside. Since its construction, the palace has seen much royal history. Two of Henry VIII's children died here, his illegitimate child, Henry Fitzroy, and his first daughter, Queen Mary I, and her heart is said to be buried in the chapel inside the palace. In the 17th century, two of King Charles I's children were born here, future kings Charles II and James II, and it was here that Charles I spent his last night alive before being taken to Whitehall for his execution in 1649. After the larger Palace of Whitehall was destroyed by fire in 1698, St. James's Palace became the principal home of the monarch in London, and it was in that year that King William III and Queen Mary II made the palace the administrative center of the monarchy, the role it still retains today. From the mid-1700s, Buckingham Palace was being used more and more by the royal family, although St. James's was still their primary royal residence. It was Queen Victoria who changed this. In 1840, Victoria married her husband, Prince Albert, at St. James's Palace, and shortly thereafter made a final and official move into Buckingham Palace, having refurbished it up to her and her husband's standards. This move would finally leave St. James behind as the ceremonial, but no longer the actual physical, residence of the reigning monarch. With the gates behind you, turn right and walk down the street known as Pall Mall until you get to Trafalgar Square. Cross the street into the square and stand near the column. As you take this walk, please listen to the next clip. You're now walking down what used to be one of the most fashionable streets in London, Pall Mall or Pall Mall. Built up during the reign of King Charles II, many wealthy people and noblemen desired houses in this area because they all flanked St. James's Park, where Charles II loved to host elaborate parties. The parties the king threw would often revolve around a ball game called Pall Mall, a similar game to croquet. The area here became so well known for these parties and this game that eventually the entire neighborhood became known as Pall Mall. This is also where the king built a home for one of his most famous mistresses, Nell Gwynn. Nell and the king were romantically involved for over a decade, and Nell bore the king two sons. After the birth of her second son, Charles gifted her a house on this street so that she could live nearby the park and he could easily visit his children. Keep an eye out for number 79 on your right-hand side, and you will see a blue plaque that commemorates Nell's home. As the centuries went on, Pall Mall became known for luxury shopping and gentlemen's clubs, such as the Royal Automobile Club at number 89, which has been here since 1908. As you pass, look to the top of that building, where you will clearly see classically carved cherubs driving early versions of cars. As you continue on this walk, you will also pass the monument to the Crimean War on your left, where the most recognizable statue will be that of Florence Nightingale. Opposite her statue, on your right, will be an equestrian statue of King Edward VII and a tall column with a statue of a man on top. That man is Frederick, Duke of York, known as the Grand Old Duke of York, who had this column here built especially for himself, as he felt he deserved a monument after over 40 years of service in the military. Rumor tells us that those who worked with him likely felt otherwise. Today, the influence of Pall Mall carries on. It's the name of a brand of cigarettes, advertised in their heyday as a cigarette of choice for the discerning gentlemen at the clubs here, and also in the National Mall in Washington, D.C., which was named after this stretch of road. Continue your walk toward Trafalgar Square, and cross the street on your left to enter the square and stand by the column before you play the next clip. You're now standing in Trafalgar Square, a location visited by millions from around the world and considered by many to be the center of London. The idea to build Trafalgar Square came about in the 1820s, and the idea was to build a, quote, Italian-style piazza in the middle of town. Whether or not they succeeded in their mission is up for you to decide. The square is named after the Battle of Trafalgar, a great British naval victory over the forces of France and Spain during the Napoleonic Wars in 1805. For this reason, the square is decorated with statues commemorating figures that took part in these victories. Three plinths in the square display statues of Major General Sir Henry Havelock on the southeast plinth, General Sir Charles James Napier on the southwest plinth, and King George IV on the east plinth. Towering over all of them is the statue of Admiral Lord Nelson, the national hero of the Battle of Trafalgar, perched on top of the 169-foot, or 52-meter, tall column, surrounded by four bronze lions. However, the fourth plinth in the square is something a little different. Originally, the westmost plinth was left empty, as, with great foresight, it was intended to be preserved as a ready-made place to put any future statues or monuments. However, nobody could ever agree on who or what should be placed here, so it remained empty until 2003. It's now in the care of the Fourth Plinth Commission, who have the responsibility of choosing a new piece of art to take up residence on the fourth plinth every year and a half to 2 years, so there's no way of telling what might be there on the day you're taking this tour. Today, Trafalgar Square is a popular public space, right in the middle of town, and a perfect location to host large events. London's myriad parades, Easter, Gay Pride, Chinese New Year, almost always finish with a huge party here in the square. Throughout the summer, West End performances, or national ballet performances, might take place here. It's a site for protests and celebrations, where thousands of Londoners came to spontaneously celebrate the end of the Second World War, and also where the final Harry Potter film had its premiere in 2011. Now, cross back over the street you came from and look for the Admiralty Pub. Take the small street just to the right of that pub called Spring Gardens. Walk down this road and continue on until you walk down the wide stone steps, or the ramp on the right, to the Mall. Cross the Mall toward the statue of James Cook and stand with your back to him. Then play the next clip. You're now standing on the Mall, the purpose-built approach to Buckingham Palace. The building on top of the road with the three arches to your right is Admiralty Arch, commissioned by King Edward VII. Edward's idea was to create a grand entrance to Buckingham Palace, similar to the Champs-Élysées in Paris, and it was he who helped lay out the plan for the arches, the long stretch of road, and the Victoria Memorial outside Buckingham Palace where you began your tour. Originally, the road leading down to Buckingham Palace was a standard London road, but in the 1950s, it was decided to turn it red to symbolize a red carpet that runs all the way down to Buckingham Palace. The Mall is the official royal line of procession for many royal events, including the King's birthday celebrations and Jubilee commemorations, as well, of course, as coronations. Originally, Admiralty Arch was given over to the offices of the Navy, also known as the Admiralty, and if you take a close look at the lampposts lining the Mall, you'll see ships placed on top, a subtle reference to the Navy who once held their offices here. Today the building actually belongs to a Spanish real estate developer who intends to turn it into a luxury 100-room hotel, complete with a private members club and a few residential apartments. From here, with Admiralty Arch to your back, walk forward and away from the arch. Take the first left and walk until you arrive at the large sandy courtyard on the left-hand side. The area you're standing in now is known as Horse Guards Parade, named after the household cavalry that work here on behalf of the royal family. You'll notice a large white building in the center with an archway in the middle. This archway is considered to be the official entrance to Buckingham Palace, even though we're around half a mile away. Yet, this archway is still used for royal ceremonial occasions, Perhaps the most famous time it was used was during the wedding of Prince William and Catherine Middleton in 2011. When the couple left Westminster Abbey after their wedding ceremony and traveled to Buckingham Palace for the celebrations, this is the way their carriage came, right through the archway. And if you look back behind you, you will notice the black asphalt of the road turns red here as it meets the Mall, an extension of the red carpet that runs all the way down to the palace. This is also where the casket of Queen Elizabeth II was borne to and from her lying in state and funeral at Westminster Abbey. Depending on when you're taking this tour, it is likely that the courtyard here is completely empty, and this is usually the case. However, throughout the year there are events that take place here. In the spring, the London Marathon finishes nearby on the Mall, and this is where they set up the tents for the runners to relax at the end of their run and regroup with their friends and family. In June, we have the King's birthday party here, known as the Trooping the Colour. Over 1,500 soldiers take part in this event, to which the public can buy tickets. Huge tiers of seats are set up around the courtyard, and as the ceremony takes place, hundreds of members of marching bands play through the area, flag displays take place, and three airplanes fly overhead, leaving trails of blue, white, and red smoke as they go. It's worth noting that we have the King's party here every June, but his actual birthday is in November. This is because all of our monarchs get two birthdays, their real one, which for His Majesty is the 14th of November, and their official one, which is always a Saturday in June, because statistically, that's when we get the nicest weather. And for those of you who are interested in the Olympics, you may have seen this courtyard on television during the 2012 Summer Games, because here, in London, Horse Guards Parade was filled with thousands of tons of sand, and this is where the men and women's beach volleyball competition was held. Now, to see the Household Cavalry, simply walk through the archway in the center, and as you come out the other side, you will enter into a much smaller courtyard. Keep walking forward, and you will then emerge between two soldiers on horseback. Just as with the Kingsguard soldiers we saw earlier, these soldiers are members of the military and are positioned here to protect the official entrance to Buckingham Palace. The building that surrounds the archway belongs to the Horse Guards, and it contains offices, rooms for them to relax so they're not on position, and stables for keeping the horses. As you stand near the horses, facing the archway you just walked through, take a glance over your left shoulder, and you will see a stone building across the street with a white bust of a man in an alcove above the door. This is all that remains of the Palace of Whitehall, a palace that stood on this site for centuries and was a favorite of many of our kings, such as Henry VIII and Charles II. In 1689, a fire tore through the palace, and only the building across the street and the name of the palace remain. As for the name Whitehall, the street you're now standing on still bears the name, and the entire area here, with all the government buildings within, are referred to colloquially as Whitehall as well. As for the building across the street, the last surviving piece of the palace, this is the banqueting house. For centuries, this would have been the scene of masques, celebrations, and royal pageantry. And in 1649, it was also witness to the only public execution of a reigning monarch. If you wish to hear the story of the English Civil War and King Charles's execution, go to the next clip. If not, walk back through the archway into the larger courtyard and find yourself back into Horse Guards Parade. Then, play the clip after the clip about King Charles. When King Charles I came to the throne in 1625, he believed, as did many monarchs before him, in the divine right of kings, an idea that God had placed him on the throne, and therefore all decisions to be made when it came to the running of the country were his to make alone. However, Parliament, which had existed in one form or another for nearly three centuries at that point, disagreed. Parliament insisted that Charles had to go through the legal parliamentary system to do things like raising taxes or declaring war on other countries. Routinely, Charles would ignore Parliament and go about his business, raising taxes and attempting to declare war on other countries entirely on his own. This led to huge struggles of power between the king and Parliament that went on, like a tug of war, for years. Finally, the struggle for power escalated and came to a head in 1641. A group of five MPs gathered together and wrote up a document called the Grand Remonstrance, which was essentially a long letter of everything the king was doing that they disagreed with. The letter was then circulated throughout the country, with a copy making its way into the hands of the king himself. Charles was furious and stormed down into Parliament, bursting into the chamber of the House of Commons while they were in session. As Charles didn't recognize any member of Parliament, having avoided them as much as possible, he couldn't identify the authors of the remonstrance from the crowd of politicians sitting in the chamber. The king drew his sword and demanded that the speaker, William Lenthal, who was in charge of the Commons, point out who was responsible for creating the Grand Remonstrance. Famously, Lenthal got up out of his seat and bowed in front of the king, saying, quote, "May it please your majesty, I have neither eyes to see nor tongue to speak in this place, but as this house is pleased to direct me, whose servant I am here. And I humbly beg your majesty's pardon that I cannot give any other answer than this is to what your majesty is pleased to demand of me." Charles was so surprised that Lenthal would defy him in such a manner that he grumbled and retreated out of the chamber. That afternoon, he gathered his supporters, traveled to Nottingham, and there officially raised an army and declared a war on Parliament. The civil war between the Royalists, those supporting the king, and the Roundheads, those supporting the parliamentarian forces, lasted for 7 years and was exceptionally bloody and brutal. It is estimated that 10% of the country's population was killed on the battlefield during the war. And it all came to an end in 1648 when Charles, having suffered multiple crushing defeats throughout the country, was captured and arrested by Parliament. King Charles was from then on referred to only as Charles Stuart and was forced to undergo a humiliating public trial. He was charged with treason, the act of betraying one's country. This claim was brought against him as Parliament agreed that as king, it was Charles's duty to protect the people of his country, and he had betrayed them by leading them into an unnecessary civil war where tens of thousands of them would be killed. And considering it was Parliament who defeated him on the battlefield, and Parliament who were also conducting the trial, it's not surprising to hear that, of course, they found him guilty, and the punishment for treason is death. So, on the 29th of January, 1649, Charles Stuart was taken to St. James's Palace for his final evening alive. On the morning of the 30th, Charles was put into a cart drawn by mules through the street for all the public to see. Crowds of thousands had turned up to jeer him as he was paraded through the streets, and many people followed his cart, cheering as he was taken to his final destination. Charles was taken to the Palace of Whitehall, and just here, outside Banqueting House, a scaffold had been erected, and waiting on top of the scaffold was an executioner with an axe. As it was January and quite cold, Charles requested that he be allowed to wear 2 shirts as he stepped onto the scaffold. He was afraid that he would shiver in the cold air, and the public would mistake that for weakness or terror at what he was about to face. His wish was granted, and wearing both shirts, King Charles stepped out of the window that you see above the door of the banqueting house onto the scaffold that was erected here. On the 30th of January, 1649, at exactly 2 p.m., the axe fell, and Charles Stuart was beheaded by his own government, all in front of a crowd of thousands who had come to watch the execution of a king. We commemorate Charles's execution here in one of the smallest memorials in all of London. If you look at the clock on top of the Horse Guards building, you will notice that next to the number 2, there's a small black mark. This mark is the lasting testimony to the fact that it was at 2 p.m. here that Charles I was executed all those centuries ago, and it is the bust of King Charles that sits above the doorway of Banqueting House, forever gazing upon the site where he met his untimely end. Now, walk back through the archway into Horse Guards Parade, and then play the next clip. Despite the fact that this courtyard is named after the Horse Guards, there are many buildings here that have nothing to do with the Household Cavalry. Facing the archway you came through, to your back left is a large concrete building covered in vines. This is the Citadel, a World War II bunker built to be right in between Buckingham Palace and the Houses of Parliament, Although never used during the war, today it has an important role as a communication center of the Admiralty. Moving along, the long building with the two green domes to the right of that is Admiralty House, previously used by the Navy, but today being used by various governmental departments. Now, facing the arch and looking to your right, you'll see huge white stone buildings going down the road. These are governmental buildings, places like the Home Office, the Foreign Office, and the Treasury. We'll be walking along those buildings in a few moments so you can get a closer look. But first, you will see between where you are standing and those large white buildings, there's a brown brick fence with barbed wire on the top and brick houses just behind it. You will also see two armed police officers with automatic weapons. Despite that potentially imposing view, walk closer to that wall, then play the next clip. You're now looking into the backyard of No. 10 Downing Street, the home of our Prime Minister. Originally, Downing Street was constructed on the orders of Sir George Downing, who had a mansion here, and who wanted to add a series of townhouses on the street, perhaps as many as 20, although there are no firm records that tell us for certain. The first known political resident of No. 10 Downing Street was Johann Caspar von Bodmer, Premier Minister of the Kingdom of Hanover, head of the German Chancery, and an advisor to the German-born King, George I. When Bodmer died in 1732, the house was offered to Sir Robert Walpole, a government minister who held the title First Lord of the Treasury. Walpole had worked exceptionally closely with King George I, as he was one of the few British politicians who could speak Latin, a necessity, as King George resolutely refused to learn to speak English, but could converse in Latin. As Robert worked closer and closer with the king, he soon became known as the Prime Minister, or the Top Minister, the minister working with the king. As a sign of gratitude for all of Robert's hard work and service to the nation, the king gifted No. 10 to Robert. However, Robert believed accepting the gift would be inappropriate, and suggested that he would live there while he was working with the king, but then when that ceased, the house should go to the next First Lord of the Treasury. As the years have gone on, the office of First Lord of the Treasury has become entwined with the job of Prime Minister, making them one and the same, and making No. 10 the home of every Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Almost. Many Prime Ministers have actually lived in No. 11, as that house is much larger, but their official residence will always remain next door at No. 10. To get a glimpse onto the street itself, as you face the backyard, turn right. When you get to the street with the statue of Lord Mountbatten on your left, turn left. A few steps down, you'll see huge iron gates and more officers with automatic weapons. This is the west entrance of Downing Street. From here, it's worth it to make a quick visit to the beautiful St. James's Park. So turn, with Downing Street behind you, and simply walk straight ahead and carefully cross the road into St. James's Park. St. James's Park is one of the most picturesque parks in London. Just like Green Park, St. James's was also a huge plot of land purchased by King Henry VIII. He bought the land here around the time he purchased the Palace of Whitehall, where you were standing just a few minutes ago. Also, similar to Green Park, St. James's Park was opened to the public by King Charles II, who used it to entertain guests and his mistresses. Throughout the 17th century, the park would gain notoriety as a place of lecherous and lewd behavior, as being on the outskirts of London meant there were few people here to monitor what the public got up to, and the many shrubs and trees in the park were perfect for hiding places for people to carry out illicit deeds. St. James's Park also is said to have a resident ghost, perhaps once a victim of the illicit deeds done here. In the 19th century, a soldier based at the barracks nearby murdered his wife and attempted to hide her decapitated body in the lake. He was caught, but it is said by many that her spirit remains here. We have two recorded incidents of this female specter. In 1804, a Coldstream guard working nearby claimed to have, quote, perceived the figure of a woman, without a head, rise from the earth at the distance of about 3 feet before me. His claims were taken seriously, as the story of the ghost was already well known by the 19th century. Later, in the 20th century, a car accident happened on the edge of the park here, owing to the St. James's Park ghost. The driver of the car involved claimed that the figure of a headless woman appeared on the edge of the park and ran in front of his car. He swerved and hit a lamppost, destroying it and damaging the vehicle. He was hauled into court and assumed to be drunk. When he calmed down, he explained to the police what had happened, and, as the story of the ghost here was believed to be true at the time, he was let go, and not declared responsible for the cost to repair the lamppost he destroyed. To continue with the walk, cross back over the street, so you're again at the gates of Downing Street, and, with Downing Street ahead of you, turn to your right and walk along until you see the entrance to the Cabinet War Rooms on your left. Underneath your feet stand some of the most important wartime rooms in the country, the Churchill War Rooms. This was the underground bunker where Winston Churchill led the British forces throughout the Second World War. Rooms underneath the Treasury Building here began to be constructed in 1938 and were completed and operational by 1939, just in time for the start of the Second World War. The bunker was fully operational until August 1945 and contains the Cabinet Room, a large room with seats reserved for the heads of various branches of the armed forces, as well as government ministers. On first being shown this room, Churchill is quoted as saying, "This is the room from which I will direct the war." And direct the war, he certainly did. Today the war rooms are somewhat of a time capsule, the rooms down here being frozen in the time the Second World War was coming to an end. Also attached to the rooms is the Churchill Museum, a wonderful museum showcasing unique pieces and belongings of the Churchills, charting Winston's entire life's work. Interesting items inside include a custom-made pair of velvet overalls for him to wear when he was spending the night underground, the original door to number 10 Downing Street that he had replaced when he moved in, and even the flag that draped his coffin during his funeral. For anybody with a keen passing interest in military history or Winston Churchill, the war rooms are an absolute must-see. With the war rooms to your left, walk forward until you get to the end of the street. Cross over, take a slight left, then take the immediate right down Story's Gate. Continue here until you get to the steps on the left that take you into a small grassy area. If you can't get onto the grass, as sometimes it's blocked off, just simply stand in front, just opposite Westminster Abbey. You're now facing Westminster Abbey, one of the best-known churches in the world. The abbey is sitting on a site that's had a church on it since at least the 600s, which means there's been a site of worship here for over the last 1,400 years. The version that stands today was built between 1042 to 1052, on top of the previous version, at the orders of King Edward the Confessor. As time has gone on, however, the abbey has been a popular project for a lot of our monarchs. Kings would want to be associated with the abbey in some way after they died, so it was very common for monarchs to add to the church, put in new tombs, update statues, replace windows, etc. This means that today, the church is in some ways like a chronological jigsaw puzzle, a beautiful mix of pieces dating from all time periods through the last 10 centuries. Today, the abbey is still associated with the royal family for a number of reasons. Firstly, because it was founded by a king. And secondly, because the church is a royal peculiar, which means it responds directly to the royal family and does not answer to anybody else. This church is also where all of our monarchs, aside from two, have had their coronations, the most recent being King Charles III and Queen Camilla's coronations on the 6th of May, 2023. And it's also where the majority of history's royal weddings took place. More recently, the abbey was where the late queen married her husband, Prince Philip, and also, of course, where William and Kate got married in 2011. And this is also where many of our monarchs are buried, such as the church's founder, Edward the Confessor, Edward I and III, Elizabeth I, Charles II, and Queen Anne, just to name a few. Take note, however, that the late Queen Elizabeth II was laid to rest at St. George's Chapel, out near Windsor Castle. It's always worth mentioning that it isn't only royalty buried in Westminster Abbey. It's also the final resting place of people such as Sir Isaac Newton, Charles Darwin, 8 prime ministers, Sir Stephen Hawking, and the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior. If you'd like to visit the Abbey today, you have two ways to do it, either as a visitor or a worshipper. As a visitor, simply go to the Abbey, purchase your ticket on admission, take the audio guide, and explore the church at your own pace. Or, if you're traveling on a very tight budget, you can visit as a worshipper. The Abbey has services throughout the week that the public are invited to and which are free to attend. To find out when the next service is, simply visit the Abbey's website at www.westminster-abbey.org. When attending a service, you'll not be free to wander through the church and see it all, but you can sit down where the guests did at William and Kate's wedding without having to pay any money to do it. Facing the Abbey, walk left toward the steps that will take you out of the grassy area. Turn left at the bottom and walk, keeping the Abbey on your right until you get to the traffic junction. Cross onto the concrete island, and then take the crossing on the left into Parliament Square. You're now standing in Parliament Square, surrounded by the statues of politicians and social campaigners from all across the globe who are considered to have done great things for the people of their nations. If you look around, you'll be able to spot recognizable figures such as Nelson Mandela, Abraham Lincoln, Mahatma Gandhi, Millicent Fawcett, the only woman commemorated here having had her statue erected in 2018, and you'll also see Winston Churchill. Churchill is probably the most famous member of Parliament of all time, and his statue is the one closest to the palace, staring straight at it from his place across the street. As you stand in the square, look across to the huge building opposite, with a tower on the far right and the clock on the far left. You're now facing your final palace of the Westminster tour, the Palace of Westminster. You may know this building better as the Houses of Parliament, and both would be right. Originally, there was a palace on this site in the 11th century, and it was used as a primary royal home until the reign of Henry VIII, when he moved out and into his larger palace of Whitehall, which stood near to where Horse Guards Parade is today. When Henry's son came to the throne, he decided to give the empty palace to Parliament. Because Parliament had existed in one form or another for over 200 years, but they had no permanent place to work by the 1500s. They had to go wherever the king told them to, and it could be anywhere in the entire country. But from 1547, they've been meeting here inside this royal palace, and that is still the case today. The palace belongs to His Majesty, and Parliament meets inside this building with his permission only. However, this is not the original palace. There was a fire here in 1834 that demolished the original building, so you're actually looking at a Victorian reconstruction, built to look much older than it actually is. There's only one surviving piece of the original palace, and it's the piece closest to the road. If you look ahead and slightly to the right, you will see one long rooftop that runs along the building closest to the street. There's a black tower about three-quarters of the way to the right on top. This rooftop sits on top of one giant room called Westminster Hall. Built in 1097, Westminster Hall has seen many huge events throughout its existence. Previously, it was the highest court in the country, and all the major nationwide trials were held here. In 1605, a man named Guy Fawkes was arrested here after attempting to blow up the Houses of Parliament. In 1649, King Charles I was tried here after he lost the Civil War against Parliament. And if you remember the film Braveheart, then you will be familiar with William Wallace, who also faced his trial in the hall. Westminster Hall was also the site of coronation celebrations for centuries. Kings would have their crowning in the Abbey, then walk across a purple carpet into Westminster Hall for a 13-hour feast and party. All the king's friends and family were invited inside, and then regular people, like us, would stand here in the courtyards, where there would be massive fountains flowing with real wine. Anybody could grab their cup and come down to celebrate the new king or queen. Unfortunately, however, they stopped doing that in the 1820s after King George IV hosted such an elaborate coronation party that he bankrupted the entire royal family. Westminster Hall was also the site of the laying in state of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. After her death in Scotland, her body was brought to London, and her casket was placed in Westminster Hall, where the public were invited to come and pay their respects to their departed queen before her funeral on the 19th of September, 2022. It is estimated over 1 million people came to visit the Queen's casket, and they lined up in a queue that at some points would last for over 24 hours. However, as interesting as Westminster Hall may be, there's only one iconic symbol of London that everybody recognizes from all across the globe, and of course, I'm talking about Big Ben. Now, position yourself wherever you would like so that you have a good view of the clock tower, and then play the next clip. If we're being accurate, Big Ben is actually the name of the bell inside the tower. The tower itself was previously known as the Clock Tower, but in 2012 it was renamed the Queen Elizabeth II Tower to commemorate Her Majesty's 60th year on the throne. Although the Queen Elizabeth II Tower is one of the world's best-known icons, it was originally never supposed to be built. After Parliament burned down in 1834, architect Charles Barry was chosen to design the new palace. To assist him, he invited another architect, his friend, Augustus Pugin, to design the inside of the palace, and it was Pugin who was given the task of creating the clock tower. The tower would be one of Pugin's last projects before he would die in an asylum shortly after the end of his 25 years of working on the palace. The tower today stands at 315 feet, or 96 meters high, and when it was completed in 1859, it was the largest clock in the entire world. The clock dials are 23 feet, or 7 meters in diameter, and contain 312 pieces of glass, and are surrounded by a Latin inscription in gold gilding that celebrates Queen Victoria, who was the reigning monarch at the time of its construction. Big Ben, the name of the bell inside the tower, was cast at the Whitechapel Bell Foundry, who also created the Liberty Bell, on the 10th of May, 1858. The bell is 13.76 tons, and at time of casting, was the largest bell in the British Isles. As to where the name comes from, Big Ben, we don't know for sure. There are two theories. Either it was named after a well-known Victorian boxer, Benjamin Strong, who had the nickname Big Ben, or perhaps it was named after a member of Parliament, Benjamin Hall, well-known for his size and stature, who also had the nickname Big Ben. Up in the tower, Big Ben is surrounded by four smaller bells that chime what's called the Westminster Chimes every 15 minutes. Big Ben himself only bongs on the hour. It is always the very first bong that Ben makes, which is the accurate time. As the Elizabeth Tower and Big Ben reached their 160th birthday, the decision was made to completely renovate the tower and the inner clock mechanism at a cost of £80 million. Beginning in August of 2017, the renovation lasted over 4 years and brought the colors and style of the famous clock back to the original design by Augustus Pugin. For example, you'll notice the numerals and dial on the clock face are now the original blue instead of the black that had been used in repairs throughout the last century. If you wish to visit the Houses of Parliament, you have two ways to do this. You can take a guided tour, which runs on Saturdays throughout the year and on various national holidays as well as the summer months. These do come at a price, which vary depending on if you wish to take the audio guide or a tour with a live guide. Or you can visit the public galleries. This is free to do, and the public is allowed inside to sit in either the House of Commons or the Lords to listen to the political debates. Visiting the Houses of Parliament will also give you access to the incredible Westminster Hall. From King George III's country retreat into the footsteps of Henry VIII and along the journey of an executed king, you have now traveled with us through centuries of Royal Westminster. If you've enjoyed your Royal London tour with us and wish to take another self-guided tour, visit our website at www.freetoursbyfoot.com. There you'll find self-guided tours of Roman London, the Beatles in London, the East End, Harry Potter, and more. You'll also find information on other audio tours that we offer, as well as our full tour schedule. Free Tours by Foot offers pay-what-you-like walking tours on a daily basis here in London, and we'd love to have you join us. Simply book online. Thank you for touring with Free Tours by Foot today, and we hope you've enjoyed every step of your journey.